Support for Gig with Mike Redman comes from Music Connection. For 45 years, connecting artists and musicians with each other and the industry. And you can find them on the web at musicconnection.com. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Gig. I'm your host, Mike Redman. Today, I have a casual conversation with Josh Rabinowitz, who Fast Company called the new music mogul, and the Cannes music jury calls a musical genius. As many of you know, I made a great living writing music, primarily for advertising, because that's where the real money was at the time. What you don't know is that I spent several of those years trying to get the attention of Josh. At Gray Advertising, he was untouchable, probably because his time was in such high demand. He's well-connected, he's an expert in his field, working with the who's who in the music industry, and from what I hear, he's also a great trombone player. I'm sure you'll pick up some terrific insights from this conversation with Josh. So enjoy this podcast as we talk about music for advertising and the music industry in general. Well, hi, Josh. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Great to see you, man.
I mean, I appreciate you spending some time with us on Gig. I noticed that you do a lot of podcasts. You do. You're really, really good at promoting and social media. And we're just going to have some pretty quick questions here because I know your time is valuable, and we'll take note of that. So, in my experience, some of the very best composers and generally cool people to hang with are the horn section. Mm-hmm. One of my best friends, we play golf a lot. Pat has got the best sense of humor of anybody that I know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I just want to start off and ask you, as a trombone player, what are a couple of your favorite bands? One of mine, for example, is the horn section and Corey Wong's band, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Great question. I love so many of the horn-oriented bands. Certainly, Earth, Wind, and Fire and Tower of Power were very influential in my life. Sly and the Family Stone had two horn players. When I was younger, a bullseye for me actually was the Blues Brothers band, which I really loved when John Belushi was not only on the number one comedy television show, the number one comedy film, Animal House, but he also had the number one album with the Blues Brothers. And wow. I loved that record. The horn players were extraordinary. And it was like a sweet spot for me in terms of my life. I was like a young man, not even a man yet. And very influenced by that music, the soul music, and the interpretations that they did. So I love that record.
Is there a little, you just made me think of something, is that have anything to do with why, excuse me, you've kind of come a little bit full circle? I think I read somewhere, heard you say that you're, you know, back into playing funk and soul music.
Yeah, I mean, I played that for years and years, mm-hmm. and I've had this band for, we just played a show this summer, the Second Step, which has played thousands of shows over the years. And I was a touring musician. That actually was something that really influenced the way I dealt with the music business when I got a full-time corporate music gig. But yes, soul and funk, I love it. I was trained in jazz and classical, and soul and funk was a lot more fun. The horn players were a lot of fun. Classical musicians can be fun. Jazz musicians can certainly be fun, but if you're playing funk, soul, R&B in the classic sense, there's a real camaraderie and fun aspect to those interactions, for sure.
Yeah, I always found the horn sections to be just a little bit crazy.
Definitely.
So, look, for many people that don't know you, for many, many years, you've been, let me in quotes, the music guy in New York City's ad agency world. Can you reflect for a minute on a couple of highlight projects for you?
I've had the fortune of doing some really high-end projects with famous people. Mm-hmm. I kind of got into the business just as it became acceptable for artists to do stuff where before it was thought of as a sellout. Now it was kind of like a sell-in because of the shift in the music industry and the digital disruption and everything. So some of the things that I had a real pleasure of working on were, the music wasn't as cool as the interactions. It was Dr. Pepper in the early 2000s, working with Black Eyed Peas on their first ad, working with LL Cool J and Run DMC, working with so many different people. At the same time, I was working on Sony electronic stuff, worked with Macy Gray and worked with Los Lonely Boys. And it was at a time where they were peaking, and their songs that we had produced for the ad were actually released by major labels. So I have production credits for major labels. And then if you flash forward to me being an independent music consultant, producer, and supervisor, I did a really great project with a band called Tank and the Bangas from New Orleans, which a place that holds a really special place in my heart. Mm. And what they did is cover version of What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love, background Al David. And they embraced many of the talented musicians and singers in New Orleans, which is just an incredible resource of amazing talent. Here's some New York City music sound effects, if you can hear the siren.
Can't even hear it, but makes me feel at home. So
yeah, it's amazing how many pass by this street. And we worked with them, and it was kind of like a We Are the World version, you know, like with all these different people singing lines and stuff. And that to me was just an amazing, meaningful project that was released not as a commercial, actually, because COVID came and the topic of the commercial wasn't as relevant, but as a full-length video and song that was released on Universal Music on Verve Records.
You know, you made me think of something else when you said this, that people are singing, probably, I assume, different lines in different locations, etc., and then you put all of that together.
In this particular case, it actually turned out that everyone was in town that they wanted to engage with. And it was right before COVID, which was kind of strange because if you look back on it, it was maybe a week or two before COVID exploded in New Orleans, a city that really got it hard. But yeah, luckily, everyone was in town and almost everyone was there at the same time, which was really fun, I must say. Yeah. Atypical, of course.
Yeah. In that old, looking back, you know, bell bottoms are back in vogue. I've been around long enough to see audio mnemonics like Nabisco rule, and then songs like "Proud to Be Your Bud," you know, where they were songs, and then straight scoring of commercials, and now we're back to mnemonics and audio branding. Where do you see it going next?
That's a really good question. I think AI is going to be a component of all of this. And sonic branding has become something really, really hot. Audio branding, mnemonics, et cetera. Clients are willing to invest a lot of money in these productions and the creation. There are a bunch of music companies now that have these excellent decks that they present and ways of dealing with it. And I think they're compensated very well. Mm. I've heard rumors back in the day that IBM was willing to spend up to $1 million on their audio branding. That might just be a rumor, but I think
that was my gig.
Yeah, that's a good gig. Yeah. That's a good gig. It might not be the best gig because there's a lot of back and forth on this stuff. You come up with so much musical content, so many great ideas. And then people listen to them. And when you're listening to 2-second clips or less, or maybe a little more, like 100 of them, it's really hard for the brain and the ear to kind of process it and come up with a great decision. But I see AI as a really strong component. I was involved with an AI company, one of my first consulting gigs, again, before COVID, that I was involved with. Was kind of a musical compositional tool that you had a couple of drop-down menus and you clicked a mood or a vibe or an aura and you could put it to picture within the platform. I thought it was like ahead of its time. Unfortunately, they got bought and utilized by another company, but I think if I was working with them now, it would be a super hot topic and a really kind of cool thing to brag about.
Yeah. The introduction of MIDI scared the bejesus out of us, you know? I mean, we all thought we're all going to be out of business now because anybody can make music. And it's different than AI because you were a composer. You were a creative person. People that weren't that creative or were not composers, they couldn't really make any more music. They just had a hammer with no nails, you know? But looking at today, we've got AI that it's got a bunch of nails because it goes back to Mozart and everybody else and analyzed everything that ever existed. So do you think there's a, how do you see it being used? I mean, maybe both, but as a tool or is it a threat to musicians, composers?
I certainly think it's a threat. Mm-hmm. I would say in the near future, the tool aspect is going to be prevalent, and it is prevalent, and people are using it. Generative AI for music, it's being used. It's a major threat to players and composers, I think, because of the ease of use. And, you know, you see it happening with college students, right? Mm-hmm. Writing papers and people creating resumes and communications with AI and marketing plans, et cetera. I know a lot of music supervisors actually use AI as well to create playlists just in case they miss something, you know, or they want some other ideas. So it's permeating culture. I do think it's a threat to musicians and composers. Like I said, I'm concerned about it, but I'm also fascinated with it. And there have been, like you said, MIDI came into play, Pro Tools and other kind of digital audio scenarios and workstations came to play, but there's still great music happening and creativity. It's just a different way of being creative.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's, I ask that question of a lot of people because I'm sure, I mean, none of us know where it's going, but it's, somebody may hit on it. One of my first books, Todd Rundgren, I asked him what the future of, you know, listening to music was, and he nailed it. He was the only one out of about 40 people that said, well, it's going to be the, you know, Rhapsody model where you just, you know, you pay for a music subscription. And this is about 12 years ago, you know, and so right now we're kind of all just speculating, I guess. So what was one of the biggest challenges for you that you faced in your job in the agency world?
The fear of music that people have and the misunderstanding of music. As the digital kind of revolution and disruption happened, people thought, oh, if I can download a song, then I can just grab it off the internet and utilize it. And they didn't understand the music rights. They didn't understand a lot of that stuff. People that were weaned, that were a little older at the time and understood music in a different way, from a more analog way, they were a lot easier to deal with. But then music licensing really kicked in and it became kind of the major force in music and branding as well as music and media, particularly television and film. And that kind of era or that demographic of creatives and production people didn't necessarily understand music rights particularly. So that was always a battle. I guess a second battle for me was dealing with people during this disruption that we wanted to use in executions, in initiatives, as creators, famous or emerging talent. Two in particular were the bands They Might Be Giants and the band Black Eyed Peas. I was asked to engage them and work with them and produce tracks with them. And I remember having long conversations with the leaders of both groups, Will.i.am and John Flansburg. And they were like concerned about stepping into the space where music intersects with brands. Again, they thought of it as a sellout and they thought it would ruin their credibility at some level. And I was like, I really don't think so. Obviously, I have an interest in getting you guys to do this. And I'm really curious about how the process is going to work creatively, musically, production-wise, strategically. But it was kind of like being a therapist. Yeah. And I found that to be very challenging because I understood where they were coming from, but I had a job to do. So from like a spiritual kind of point of view, I was like, yeah, it is kind of a sellout. But, you know, history has shown with both those bands that I think their monetization happened way more in media than it did. Maybe not Black Eyed Peas. They had some major hits, but I'm sure some of the deals that they did with media and ads, they are considered the most corporate band in the world at some point. And Will.i.am is very involved currently with all types of brands in technology and music. So I think it kind of opened their eyes to the possibilities. It was in the early years, and then it became an extraordinary success story for both of them.
Totally different thing. You know, you were, how did, you know, you're a musician. One of the things I'd like to impart in this podcast is to musicians that want to either just be a, you know, talent, engineer, producer, you know, whatever, that there's so many wonderful jobs out there that you can make, you know, a great living, have a vacation, have a family, buy a home. And so that's something that you've done. You know, you're a musician and you took what you call the corporate job at Gray Advertising. And so I guess my question is, while you were doing that for so many years, how did you stay close to the music that you love?
It's a great question. It was kind of a professional imperative for me to stay close to music. Interestingly, the music that I loved sometimes took a back seat because I was so focused in on recording and producing music and spending a lot of brain and ear or ear brain or brain ear time with it. And for those of us who have been in the studio, you know what that can do. It really fills your mind up with repetitive sounds and stuff. It could drive one crazy. But the music that I always loved, you know, I continued to play music during the early years of my professional production and supervision time at Young and Rubicam and at Gray Advertising. So I was connected, you know, I had my ear to the street and I was connected to what was going on. But, you know, as I got older, it was harder to stay connected and harder to have that meaningful interaction with the music I loved. And also, I think it's kind of a problem, an occupational hazard, to use a cliche. When you're in music, you become really analytical and you have to stay on top of what's out there. As you get older, you might not like what's out there as much. So that kind of caused a shift. And I would say, you know, now that I'm more independent, I'm able to kind of tap into the things that really I'm passionate about and that, that inspire me musically.
Yeah.
But there was a period of time where I kind of stepped away from it. So that's a really good question. For sure, I think it happens to a lot.
And if I were a company and large brand, would you tell me a little bit about Brooklyn Music Experience and maybe the 30-second pitch for why I should engage with you to help us?
Well, people are spending way too much money on music, I feel like, not to disparage composers and musicians. In the corporate world, not a lot of people understand what the actual value of music is, like I said before, but I think there's an overspending. I can help them be efficient with it. But essentially, I've produced over 10,000 tracks for media, which is a lot of stuff. Pardon me. And I kind of experienced every type of scenario that you can imagine. So I've been in the trenches. I've had to fix things many times. I understand music rights. And it's that balance between the left brain and the right brain, the efficient negotiational financial side with the creative side. And I think experience goes a long way. That's why I call the company Brooklyn Music Experience. I'm from Brooklyn. That's where I was schooled and weaned. Now it's a hipster part of the world. Before, it was just a regular kind of streetwise aspect of culture, geographically. From music, I have a wide range of music experience from all these productions and all these interactions. And the experience aspect is I think, vital. There are a lot of people that have great taste out there and know really great music, but do they know how to execute and do it in a financially responsible, music rights management appropriate way? I'm not sure that there are.
No, I can... I'll second that. I know there's not. There are people out there, but I think that most companies that they need that help. They need that experience because music is very foreign to most of these companies. And being a business of young people, you're bringing people in all the time, and their depth of experience of music and things is actually very shallow. So having somebody like yourself with a lot of experience, you can, I don't want to say educate, it's not the right word. You can expose them to lots of opportunities that they have no idea they exist.
Exactly. And, you know, that's also why I teach. I've been a professor now for 17 years at the New School in New York City at NYU, at Tufts University, Drexel, and Brooklyn College. I really enjoy teaching. And what I enjoy about teaching is two things. The first is you're obviously educating and sharing and mentoring people and helping aspirational minds kind of execute in the music world and give them, like this podcast, we're kind of being educational and sharing information. But the second reason is that when I was like 21, 22, I had no idea what I wanted to do with music. I had no understanding that someone who was creative, smart enough, musical, actually could do something besides play their instrument, right, and maybe like manage a band or be an agent and help people get gigs and get work. There's like an intersection between music and creativity that's really spectacular now.
Okay, I've got a couple more things here. I'm going to skip a few because of your, I know that you're a busy guy. And so we're going to do some rapid fire. You up for that? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Favorite brand of all time?
Sony Electronics for me was my favorite brand because I got to do some cool stuff.
Best type of client to work with?
Somebody that appreciates expertise and collaboration.
Okay, that's good. Best funk song ever?
Oof. I can't say that there's one great best ever. There's so many great ones.
You gotta have one, brother.
I can't do it. Oh, man. Okay, we want the funk by P-Funk. I mean, I can say that, you know, because it's musically funk. There's so many great songs.
One thing you'd change about your younger self?
I would have tried to get a little more educated about the possibilities in music when I was younger. Mm.
Someplace you've always wanted to play a gig?
Madison Square Garden.
Mm. Yeah, I'd take that one. Mm-hmm. Best musician you've ever worked with? One of the best musicians you've ever worked with. TikTok.
I know, it's so hard. This one is just for so many reasons, because I've worked with great classical and jazz musicians who I really respect.
Okay, I'll change it. One last version. One last version. Best funk musician you've ever worked with.
Oof.
Best street musician in the subway.
Me, I was a street musician for a while. I was a great street musician. Best funk musician I've ever worked with. Gosh. Milo Z.
Okay. Okay. You made it through. usually I end with this same one question, but today I'm going to make it two. So the first one's this. If I was a composer, what would be the best way for me to get the attention of a large agency music director like Mike Ladman, Paul Greco, Michael Freeman these days?
Great question. I would say going to a conference and having a face-to-face rather than trying to do it digitally.
Hmm. Very nice. Okay, here's the last question. If I wanted to be Josh Rabinowitz and head up a big music department, what would be your best advice to me related to how I should get started?
Study the industry, see what the great work is, learn how to speak eloquently and creatively about music. And that's a great start.
Josh, thank you so much, brother. This has really been fun. I hope we get to talk again. I can see that we get along really well.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. And I appreciate you and all that you do. And I think so many people do.
Well, thank you. Theme music for Gig with Mike Redman was composed and produced by Other Animal. Thank you for joining me today for another episode of Gig with Mike Redman. If you like what you heard, I'd ask that you subscribe and like us. And finally, if you have questions about a job or ideas for an episode, contact me at gigwithmikeredman@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm Mike Redman, signing off.